words at just the right moments. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where we strive to be an open-hearted and open-minded group. If this is one of your first times here, we'll have a spot later on when you can introduce yourselves if you want to. I try not to stare at you too long so you feel that you have to do that. We welcome you, though, wherever you are on this journey of life, whatever your gender orientation, your sexual preference, your abilities or disabilities, your ethnicity, we welcome you. The opening words are written by Barbara Peskin. For the beauty of the earth, this spinning blue-green ball, yes, Gaia, mother of everything, we walk gently across your back to come together again in this place, to remember how we can live, to remember who we are, to create how we will be. Gaia, our home, the lap in which we live, welcome us. Solstice by Diane Lee Mumy. Again did the earth shift. Again did the nights grow short and the days long. And the people of the earth were glad and celebrated, each in their own ways. First listening point. Oh, such inherent joys are often lost. I also know that, being deep within us, their latent glow can be fanned to flame again by awareness and an open mind. And this from Rachel Carson, from Sense of Wonder. If I had influence with the good fairy who is supposed to preside over the christening of all children, I should ask that her gift to each child in the world be a sense of wonder, so indestructible that it would last throughout life, as an unfailing antidote against the boredom and disenchantments of later years, the sterile preoccupation with things that are artificial, the alienation from the sources of our strength. If a child is to keep alive his inborn sense of wonder, his or her, some of these readings were written before we got a little more conscious about the pronouns. If a child is to keep alive his or her inborn sense of wonder without any such gift from the fairies, he or she needs the companionship of at least one adult who can share it, rediscovering with him or her the joy, excitement, and mystery of the world we live in. Parents often have a sense of inadequacy when confronted on the one hand with the eager, sensitive mind of a child, and on the other with a world so complex, of such complex physical nature, inhabited by a life so various and unfamiliar that it seems hopeless to reduce it to order and knowledge. And so in a mood of self-defeat, they exclaim, how can I possibly teach my child about nature? Why, I don't even know one bird from another. I sincerely believe, Carson writes, that for the child and for the parent seeking to guide him or her, it is not half so important to know as to feel. If facts are the seeds that later produce knowledge and wisdom, then the emotions and the impressions of the senses are the fertile soil in which the seeds must grow. The years of early childhood are the time to prepare the soil. Once the emotions have been aroused, a sense of the beautiful, the excitement of the new and the unknown, a feeling of sympathy, pity, admiration, or love, then we wish for knowledge about the object of our emotional response. Once found, it has lasting meaning. It is more important to pave the way for the child to want to know than to put her or him on a diet of facts. She or he is not ready to assimilate those facts. Then, I was growing up in a small town in rural Pennsylvania. And then I lived outside as much as possible. There was the Allegheny River and French Creek and what we called hills, but the people from Cleveland called mountains. The Appalachians, and that is the way we pronounced it. Where my sister still kayaks all summer through those hills and those woods. Woods, woods, woods. Trees, trees, trees. I thought that this was how the whole world was. Green, lush, full of so many trees, streams, rivers, creeks, or cricks, as we called them. Surely one of the most beautiful places on earth. And I thought every place was just like this. And in that then time, in those days of my childhood, I thought that there would always be trees and hills and woods and streams and lakes and rivers, and that this kind of beauty would abide forever. That was then. This is now. It's true what Sigurd Olsen wrote. While we are born with curiosity and wonder and our early years full of the adventures they bring, I know such inherent joys are often lost. And then I have to remember that not everyone's early years are full of the kind of adventures I had outside, that curiosity and wonder that the natural world can create. It depends on where you were born. It depends greatly upon the attitude your family of origin has or had about nature, the natural world, the great outdoors. I fortunately had parents and grandparents who loved camping and exploring not only local county and state parks, but national parks back in the day when the popular ones were not so crowded. That was then. This is now. And to be fair, I always need to remind myself that for whatever reasons, not everyone shares my love of nature and of being out in it whenever possible, nor is everyone physically able, of course, to tramp around in the wild places or even the sort of wild places. And similarly, not everyone wants to or longs to be outside. At a program committee a few weeks ago, when we were catching up a little on each other's lives, one person told us that she was really looking forward to an upcoming trip to the Southwest and to a wilderness camping adventure in the desert where there would be no electricity or hot water. I believe this was for a week, and there's no water, period, maybe. Another person looked horrified and asked incredulously, why? Why would you even consider doing such a thing? So I am well aware of the fact that not everyone shares my desire, my need to be free, outside free. My personal cosmology, that is, my personal view of the nature of the universe, is heavily nature oriented. One of the main reasons that I went on that around the world bicycle trip for supposedly a year in the year 2000 was that it would give me the opportunity to be outside for an entire year. Perhaps you will understand why I struggle so much with winter and those times when you just can't be outside for any length of time. And if I didn't live in Wisconsin, I might be inclined to build a living space like Henry's cabin, designed so that many of my activities could be done outside. I would just kind of be able to reach to the garden and then half sit out the window in the library and dance down to the pond if I wanted to have a ballroom. But even if you don't share my enthusiasm for the outdoors, even if you didn't grow up with campers, swimmers, tennis players, boaters, bicyclists, you are just as invested in what is happening in the environment as I am. More words of wisdom. John Burroughs. I am in love with this world, he writes. I have nestled lovingly in it. I have climbed its mountains, roamed its forests, sailed its waters, crossed its deserts, felt the sting of its frosts, the oppression of its heats, the drench of its rains, the fury of its winds, and always have beauty and joy waited upon my goings and comings. From a Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, man, and I'm not going to change the gender, always kills the things he loves. And so we, the pioneers, have killed our wilderness. Some say we had to. Be that as it may, I am glad I shall never be young without wild country to be young in. Of what avail are 40 freedoms without a blank spot on the map? And this from Thoreau's writings. The birds I heard today, which fortunately did not come within the scope of my science, sang as freshly as if it had been the first morning of creation. Now there has been a sea change. And, well, a sea change in nature and in the environment. So I did look up sea change, although it seemed kind of obvious what it is. And the first definition was a change that the sea makes. Okay. But the second one is a marked change, transformation. So we know, we're educated folks, we know there has been a sea change in the environment, in climate. But can we see change in our response to this sea change? Yes, I had a lot of fun with that. Right now, instead of change, and I mean systemic change, I'll get to that in a minute. Right now, I wrote this in the present tense. It says, I see only gloom and doom. But I want to put that in the past tense. I have seen only gloom and doom in recent months and years. And I have seen only dire statistics and grim projections about what is going to happen to this planet if we don't make some drastic changes in the way we live and in our habits. A combination of record snowfall in Madison in mid-April, record-breaking 90 degrees or above, I think 4 days in a row in late May, and a personal best for me of a 70-degree temperature change. I went on one of my Southwest trips in May, left here, it was 36 maybe, got to Las Vegas, it was 101. So that's not terribly unusual at certain times it's unusual. It was hot for Las Vegas even. All of this brought my attention sharply back to planet Earth and to having to express some of this. And, how many of you know what intersectionality is? It's the buzz term, I think, kind of now. It's an in term, which is a very good term, that word. And this is really simplifying it, but that all oppressions, all injustices, all are connected. That fits right in with Unitarian Universalist philosophy, that we're all connected. I've been off on a few other injustices. Some of you might have been here for some of those, having to do with people of color. So backing off on that one for a while, because you all didn't necessarily like what I was saying on that one, so now I thought it's time to get back to climate. I have done services here, several, about the environment and about sustainability and about recycling and this and that. But they weren't, I didn't think they went deep enough until the last two I did on the subject, which was about systemic change and how we have to change our institutions and we have to stop using fossil fuels. And you know, I don't have to repeat all this. You all know this, I think. But the problem is, and this won't surprise anybody either, is it's such a huge problem, the environment, one that most of humanity doesn't seem to want to confront. So I thought that it was time to do some catching up on what's been happening in this critical fight to save the world from ourselves, but without scaring us away and without, you know, one reaction to all these statistics and everything, and one common reaction is people just really disengage. It's too big, it's overwhelming, so on and so forth. Guess when I did those last two sermons, reflections, whatever we call them here. April and May of 2015. Time goes so fast. So, we're going to try to bring ourselves up to date, but not this morning. We're more celebrating Earth. I was talking to a friend a few days ago about, I found it. The Persig, which I will use another time. I was talking to a good friend the other day about, well, we were just talking, and then of course we went off on the state of the world, because we always do, and especially in this country, and she used the word immobilized, as in, I feel so immobilized. She didn't have to explain what she meant. I got it. So I'm back to climate change, and I think that this is climate change, and I'm not going to say this right, so you Latin scholars can correct me. The sine qua non, that which there, without which there is nothing, right? You know that term? I think people still use that. Yes. I used to think that the proliferation of nuclear weapons was sine qua non. That if we, what I mean by that is the basic problem in the world. If we don't solve it, the rest are moot. But now I'm back to thinking, no, it's the environment. If we don't take care of the environment, what difference do all those other problems make? We just won't be here. This is my up sermon. Okay. In that opening hymn, we sang these words, "Pilgrims, we march along, singing our joyous song." What exactly is a pilgrim? You think you know, but you might not. Could being one help us out here? Pilgrim, one who journeys in foreign lands. A wayfarer. A traveler, especially on foot. Pilgrimage, I love this definition, the course of life on earth. That's where we are. All of us, we humans, we're on a pilgrimage, and we are making our way through a foreign land. And the foreign land is what is happening to the environment and how we change that. Here are a couple of yard signs I've noticed recently. Don't panic, it's organic. That one just thrilled me. It was, you know, one of those, looks when they spray pesticides to take out the weeds and whatever, and I'm always like, I've told my landlord, do not spray any pesticides in front of my apartment. He said, well, will you weed? And I said, well, of course I will, which I never do. But anyway, so there was that. And then, you know, it said, don't panic, it's organic. And then some small letters that said, explained about how it wasn't your usual chemical pesticide. May be true, may not be, we don't know. But it still made me feel good. And the other one was this one, which you've all seen. Drive as if your kids live here. Okay? And I saw, live as if your kids live here. And then a picture of the earth. Why don't we use advertising for this kind of thing? I mean, advertising is obviously very, very successful. Words of wisdom. Sigurd Olsen, again, Reflections from the North Country. Awareness is becoming acquainted with environment, no matter where one happens to be. Man or woman does not suddenly become aware or infused with wonder. It is something we are born with. No child need be told its secret. He or she keeps it until the influence of gadgetry and the indifference of teenage satiation extinguish its intuitive joy. This is written way before the gadgetry of today. And from Wendell Berry, The Unforeseen Wilderness. And the world cannot be discovered by a journey of miles, no matter how long, but only by a spiritual journey, a journey of 1 inch, very arduous and humbling and joyful, by which we arrive at the ground at our feet and learn to be home. And my last reading is an Indian proverb. The frog does not drink up the pond in which he lives. It's a good one, isn't it? So what happens next? Well, this won't surprise you, but when I say that a lot depends on how we educate our children. Holly and I actually didn't plan this, that they would be working on sustainability downstairs, and I would be doing some services up here about the environment, but it certainly is working out well. Next, we change our systems. We change our lives, but we do that, and I talked about this 3 years ago, and I'm just going to briefly mention it now. We change the human story. We change the narrative. We change it from a model of markets and money to a model of sustainability and caring about each other. You all know this. But I say the same thing probably every time I'm up here. But it has to be, it needs to be said. And Prairie can be, and many other faith traditions can be very proud of the work that we all do to move the human story. It takes a very long time. Hope. Bill McKibben, many of you will be familiar with McKibben, author, environmentalist. He hasn't written much lately, so I went looking for him. Actually, a nice librarian did that for me. And he is writing. He's writing fiction now. Maybe he thinks he can reach more people that way. He's also writing, he writes all sorts of forewords to all sorts of books. He also writes magazine articles. He has a good article in the current Rolling Stone, except it's online. It's not in a printed magazine. Hit Fossil Fuels Where It Hurts, the bottom line. So McKibben says hope has to be real. And maturity is the opposite of despair. And we have to base hope on maturity. And we have to get real. Joanna Macy says the primary barrier that prevents us from doing what is necessary to save the planet is our inability to face the realities of our world. We have to keep that in mind. And what struck me when I was reading all these different sources for this morning was reality, includes beauty and joy. And that's why I chose the quotes at the top, the Emerson one about flowers and the other one. Hope has to be real. So we're educable. And we can base hope for saving the planet on knowing we have the ability to figure out the root causes of problems. There's a very ancient, I'm almost sure it's South Asian parable. Some of you will know this, about people who live by the side of a river and they're doing things along the river. Women are probably washing the clothes. when a baby floats by and someone manages to grab the baby and save it, and then another one, and then more. And these villagers set up a wonderful system for saving these babies that are floating by, until finally somebody says, who's putting these babies in the water, in the stream, in the river? Shouldn't we go find out what the cause is? We have that ability. We base hope on knowing that we're not alone in this world, that others are fighting the fight. I said this 3 years ago, go to 350.org, join up. It's Bill McKibben's organization where we humans are trying to get the parts per million down to 350, right? Molly, you're nodding your head. I'm vague on science stuff, but it's a good organization. Remember that you are not alone. How many of you get the UU World, and how many of you read the current issue, the story on page 8 about the 10-year-old Unitarian Universalist plaintiff? Levi Draham lives in Washington, D.C. He and 20 other young people, although he's the youngest, 20 other plaintiffs are asking the courts in this country, and it's now worked its way up to the Supreme Court, to mandate, quote, that the United States government reduce carbon emissions to 350 parts per million by 2100. Because it's a violation of the plaintiff's Fifth Amendment constitutional rights not to be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. You are not alone. We aren't alone. We can base hope on so many things. Study the seven principles. No, not those seven principles. In searching for anything McKibben wrote, he wrote the foreword to this Diet for a Hot Planet by Anna LaPay, is that how you say her last name? And here's a whole section, Eat the Sky, Seven Principles of a Climate-Friendly Diet. So, you know, my ears perk up when I see seven principles. So they're in this book, and I undoubtedly will talk about them another time. To be effective, change has to be systemic. We have to change the narrative, change the story of humanity. And there are a whole lot of people out there working on that. Changing the narrative is not pie in the sky wishful thinking. It's a requirement for humans. It is real. It is necessary. It is hard work. That last hymn, the last line of the first hymn, ends with, age after age we rise, buoyant and brave and strong. The song will resound while life and mountains last. I hope the mountains that I always called hills last in Pennsylvania, one of the lands of fracking. And you are reminding me that I meant to say that I think we need both the individual efforts that you're all talking about and also systemic change. One figure I ran across was, 8 million tons of plastic bags go into the ocean every year. 8 million tons. I heard that on the BBC News 2 nights ago. Another thing that I did want to say was when I was held up the article about if you don't invest, you divest. There are an amazing number of big companies and churches that are getting out of owning any fossil fuel stocks. And wasn't there something about Harvard not terribly long ago that they decided not to divest? And they've taken a lot of flack for that. But there's a wonderful cartoon in the New Yorker where the people are, have died and they've gone to hell, obviously, because there's fire and brimstone and pitchforks and the devil. And one of the devils says, as an additional torment, and the person entering hell is an activist and says no on oil, as an additional torment, our fire and brimstone are fueled by coal. closing words are "Peace of Wild Things" by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty of the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. May it be so. Go in peace, greet your neighbor. Did I see the bakery person?
Yeah.
I must not have been here for a long time on a second Sunday. So, buy bakery goods.